This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, our guest is Robert Silverman. We're going to be talking about growing up Jewish in the Midwest, particularly in Champaign-Urbana as an example. Now, your mother was born here, you were telling me?
My mother was born in Urbana in 1917.
And tell me about how she got here.
My grandfather, Benjamin Brown, and my grandmother, Miriam Brown, they came from Russia. They left in the late 1890s. It's not clear exactly which date. I've heard 1898. They went to New York City. They stayed there a few years. And then he apparently had a friend living here in Urbana, and he came to Urbana.
Now, there were not many Jewish folks in this part of the country then.
I'm not sure about that. He first shows up in the Champaign-Urbana telephone directory in 1907. Mm-hmm. There was a Jewish community here. My father, who came from Romania, has a similar story where his family ended up in Danville around the same time, around the early 1900s. And there was, at that point, a pretty thriving Orthodox community in Danville. Hmm. And as I understand it, there were a number of these small Orthodox communities around the Midwest.
But they were distinct minorities.
Probably.
Yeah. And what was it like for you? You were born actually in Chicago, you said.
I was born in Chicago in 1951.
And how old were you when you left Chicago?
I was two.
Two, and you came?
My parents decided to move back to Champaign. And as I understand it, there was a decision to be made either to move. They were living in the north side of Chicago, and there was a decision to either move to Skokie or move back to Champaign, and they chose Champaign. And I used to joke how life would have been very different for me had we decided to move to Skokie.
Sure. But growing up as a Jewish minority in Champaign, where the largest majority are Protestant Christians, then Catholic Christians, and then maybe even Orthodox Christians, what was it like being Jewish as a kid?
For me, I think the predominant emotion that I had during much of my childhood and adolescent years was embarrassment. I really didn't have a very... I knew I was Jewish. That was never the issue. I didn't understand very much. I participated. I was bar mitzvahed at 13. I participated in the local Sunday school.
So your parents were observant?
No.
They were not?
Really.
Ah.
No, we did not do any... I mean, we did, I guess, what's still the basic rituals. We would go to services on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. We'd go either have a Seder or attend the Seder. Hanukkah, we would make potato pancakes. I mean, it was we followed the rituals. We didn't.
Just a few big high holy days a year, sort of.
Exactly. We didn't. Okay. My mother, we didn't light candles. We didn't have Shabbat dinners. My father worked mostly.
So didn't keep kosher at home.
Did not keep kosher.
So this is Passover week. Your family would, you said, have had a Seder, had a home, would you say celebration of Passover, remembrance of Passover?
Sure.
Okay. But just that much. So what were you embarrassed about?
I think mostly I was embarrassed that I had one Jewish friend, and he was less Jewish than I was. And so I think part of it is I just didn't have any understanding of what it meant to be Jewish. I had very little understanding of the history of it. I knew that I was sort of forced to go to Sunday school. I was forced to take Hebrew lessons when I was 12 years old so that I could be bar mitzvahed at 13. And I did it, and it was fine. It wasn't like I fought it too much. I just had really not very – I didn't have a very – good understanding of what that was about.
Did you encounter prejudice, discrimination, hostility?
Not growing up here. I mean, there were some jokes made about this or that sometimes, but I never felt like it was a personal thing. I mean, I had good friends and hung out with friends. I did experience some of that in college. I was at a couple of events where...
You went to SIU.
I went to SIU.
Southern Illinois University.
Right. And I was in the... I was working for a what was called an alternative social service agency at the time, titled Synergy was the name of it. And I had a friend who was African-American who worked there, and one day there was a ceremony on the for a new social service building that was being built in Carbondale. And he invited me to go. They were having a community celebration, so I went with them. And in the room, there were a few hundred people, and I think I was the only white person in the room. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful celebration. It was terrific. And the last speaker to get up was somebody who basically he started out with, "We know what the truth is, and we know who the people are that really control things, and the Jews this and the Jews that." At the time, I really didn't know who Louis Farrakhan was, but... Mm-hmm. Now looking back or remembering that time, he was probably a disciple of Louis Farrakhan, and he went with that kind of language. And after hearing that for a few minutes, I went to my friend and I told him that I was Jewish. I don't know that he knew that. Mm-hmm. And I said, "I really don't want to stay and listen to this." Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time being very embarrassed that I did not stand up and walk out and try to stop him from having that talk. At the time, I felt bad about that. I don't know what I would have done, but I remember thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was at college age, and before that, you said there wasn't any hostility or discrimination that you were aware of. But on the other hand, were you a target for people who were trying to convert you to Christianity? Because in the Midwest, there are many evangelical Christians who feel it's their calling to try to get people to believe what they believe, what they think is true.
I don't remember it. I remember, and I don't know if this was in high school or just after high school in the first few years of college, that this would have been the early 1970s. I graduated high school in 1969, mm-hmm. so right around that time, I think the movement was called, there were people that were called Jesus freaks. Mm-hmm. And I had a few friends who sort of fell into that category. And we were friends, I don't remember any kind of conversion talk like that.
Mm. I know roughly in that time there was groups called Young Life, that was an evangelical Christian group active in high schools. There was Youth for Christ, that was very evangelical during that time. But you were never invited to go on some of their weekends and then talk to about Jesus.
No, nope, never happened.
Interesting. Here you were, an obvious target.
I think I do remember 1967. I was, a freshman or sophomore in high school, and a lot of activity around the house dealing with Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, that was right during the Six-Day War time. So I remember my father's participation in various Jewish groups where that was talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I had a very sophisticated understanding of it, but I remember that.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Robert Silverman about growing up Jewish in small towns, in relatively small towns in central Illinois in the Midwest. Robert Silverman eventually became the director of the Jewish Federation in Champaign-Urbana and has been a board member of the Hillel Foundation and very active in Jewish life. He's now a professional counselor and works particularly with youth. We can talk some about that later on. If you have questions for our guest, please call us. The number anywhere this program can be heard is 1-800-222-9455. That's a free call, of course, 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. See, we have a caller already. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes, you know me, and I know Rob. That's my comment. Also, I wanted to ask a question about compassion. Can you teach compassion, Rob? I'm not a Jewish person, but I really respect the Jewish faith, and can you teach compassion? I have a calendar. It says compassion becomes habitual. How does it become habitual? That's my question.
In my opinion, I think that compassion can be taught. In the work that I do, I focus a lot on the word skills. And one of the groups that I work with is called the Champaign County Operation Snowball. And kids joke with me sometimes because when I say the word skill, they just kind of moan because I say it so often. But I think everything is a skill, and I think these skills can be taught. Compassion, while it's an emotion, it's a behavior, and any behavior, I think, that if we pay attention to what makes that behavior occur, I think that we can teach it. How does it happen? I think it happens through many communication skills, listening skills, learning to listen to somebody else, the skill of empathy, being able to put yourself in somebody else's position. I think if you do that in an honest way, I think compassion is the natural byproduct of that.
And is that something that you learned as part of your Jewish education that you received in synagogue and training for your bar mitzvah?
Probably. I remember language like that being used at home. My father worked in a field where he worked with a lot of minorities. And one of the earlier memories I have, and it's an irony in terms of the way that I grew up, because my father was in the retail liquor business, and he was in the retail liquor business in Chicago, and he was offered a job being a manager of a store here in Champaign, which is why he moved back to Champaign. And at the time that I was growing up, there were separate stores that sold alcohol. And people thought about liquor stores in a different way than they think about it today, where every grocery store and every 7-Eleven now it's just another product. But at that point, it wasn't quite the same. And I do remember some comments from people talking about that in terms of it being an immoral business or a bad business, something like that. And so the point of the story is that we used to go out to dinner, and I had to ask him once, because he knew everybody that was a cook or a bartender or a busboy or a janitor. And at one point I asked him about it, because many of the people who had jobs like that in those days were African American. And my father was a believer in community business. And so I would get my hair cut in the black-owned barbershop next to my father's store, and we would take our cleaning to the cleaning store that was down the street from his store, because it was about participating in the community.
Did you live in that neighborhood?
We did not live in that neighborhood. But my father had a number of friends and managers and people who worked with him and for him who were African American, and so that was a very natural part of my life. And he used to make statements, civil rights statements at home, and I grew up with statements like that in terms of the sameness, I guess, of everybody. So if that's a compassionate, I mean, that's what I think of when I think of compassionate statements coming from growing up in my home. Mm. My mother was a volunteer for, I forget the name of the organization, but she typed books in large print for people who had trouble seeing.
I see.
So they were always doing volunteer work for various groups.
When you were in college, did you get involved in the usual bull sessions, late night sessions talking about religion and philosophy? Did you speak from a Jewish perspective at that point? Were you a practicing agnostic? What were those years like?
I suppose I was a practicing agnostic, although I didn't know what the term meant at that time. Mm-hmm. My mother used to, nagged me about going into the Hillel Foundation at SIU, and I never went, or I went perhaps once. When I was on the board of the Hillel Foundation here in town, this was a decade ago, we used to have meetings, and one of the meetings was, how do we get in, the majority of Jewish students on the university who don't attend anything at the Hillel Foundation? And my statement was, the only way people would have gotten me into Hillel is to have tied me up and carried me in, because I just wasn't going to go.
Sure.
And it's...
And you weren't interested.
I was not interested.
Why were you act... Or was it an active resistance?
I think the answer to this is a novel, which hopefully I'll write one of these days. Somewhere when I began to be interested in my Jewish background, in any Jewish background, I was about 33, 34 years old.
I see.
And when I tried to make sense out of why it took so long or what had happened that caused that to sort of stay alive for all those years, so that there was something there for me to wake up to, it was complicated, and it went back to some kind of childhood understanding that this stuff is just too complex, and I knew that I wasn't able to deal with it. And I think I just put it on hold, and that was a very strong barrier for me, that there was a barrier that I had inside myself that I wasn't going to let myself cross until I knew that I had the wherewithal to make sense of it.
Hmm. When you dated, did you consciously try to date Jewish females, women, or not?
I was aware of that. I wasn't. I sort of went back and forth in terms of whether that was important to me or not. Mm. It was probably around the time where I, once it became clear to me that my Jewish identity was a fundamental part of who I was, then it was obvious that, you know, I would participate in Jewish social events, Jewish singles events, things like that. But before that happened, it wasn't clear to me that was that important.
Okay. So when it finally happened to you, when you finally came to that realization, was it gradual, sudden? Was there a traumatic experience? Was there a burning bush?
It was a short story. And I suppose it had to do with family illnesses. In 1980, I was finishing up my master's degree in counseling in Carbondale, and my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. And at that point, I was just starting to work in an agency where I was working with families who were in various kinds of trouble. And I had one of these epiphanies where my father was having a difficult time because of my mother's new diagnosis. And so I decided that if I really believed in participating in this field where my goal was to help people and work with people, then I kind of had to, I was looking at myself right in the eye, and I said, well, I have to go home and I have to make sense of my own family here. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that, you know, I was close to my parents. We weren't best friends or anything like that, but we were close. There were no big arguments. But it wasn't a real sort of heart-to-heart kind of connection at that point. And so I moved back to Champaign in 1981 perhaps, and I participated in my, you know, caring for my mother during her illness. She eventually died in 1983. There was a couple of years there where I helped my father manage the stores and sort of said for the last time that I did not want to go into the business. Mm-hmm. And the store sold in 1983. And as these things often happen, my father retired in April of 93 and my mother died in October of 83. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, going through events like that, while I don't know that it was particularly a Jewish event, I mean, it is now. I understand the ritual of Jewish tradition now much more than I did then. Because when my father died in 1991, I experienced that in an entirely different way that I'm happy to talk about. But in 1983, when my mother died, I didn't have the Jewish connection to make sense of that in a traditional Jewish way.
And how did that develop? What were the first steps or the first realizations? You talked about it as almost an epiphany.
Well, what happened was after my mother died in 1983, my father ended up about 4 months later with heart failure in a California hospital. He was visiting his brother, and he survived the heart failure. I went to California for about 8 weeks. He had surgery out there. He recovered out there, and I came back to Champaign, and he came back to Champaign about 2 months later. And I helped take care of him for about a year while he got back on his feet, and then he eventually remarried. About a year later, year and a half later. When he remarried, I took a deep breath, and I had always been a writer. I was participating in a local writers group, the Red Herring Fiction Writers. And one of the...
And you had a master's in fine arts before you had the master's in counseling?
No.
No?
No, I had the master's in counseling
first.
Already.
Uh-huh.
I was working in the counseling field here in Champaign for... At that point, it was a child adolescent program of the Mental Health Center, and I worked for the Children's Home and Aid Society, and I worked for Prairie Center for Substance Abuse and a variety of different youth organizations.
Okay. Okay.
And I was doing my writing on the side. I edited a number of classes at the university with some terrific teachers, Paul Friedman and George Skoufis, who has now passed away, Mark Costello. And one of the days, Mark Costello said to me, have you ever thought of going to get an MFA?
I see.
And at that point, I, you know, as naive as I was, I didn't even know what an MFA was.
Uh-huh.
So I sent out my application to a number of schools and was surprised to be accepted into a number of different MFA programs. So I went to Bowling Green State University in Ohio.
Okay.
They have a very dedicated to writing program. It's a it's not an academic program. I really wasn't interested in being an academic professional in the English world or teaching world. So this was mostly about writing. And my advisor was a guy named Philip O'Connor, who was a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Mm-hmm. And he would always comment on the Jewish content of my stories, and I used to get mad at him because I didn't know what he was talking about. And after a year of this,
because you certainly weren't aware of it,
I was not aware of it. And after a year of it, I finally let it sink in that he knew something that I didn't know. And the moment I sort of let down that barrier and recognized that there was something in my stories that was Jewish, that's where this epiphany came, and this entire world opened up before me that I didn't really know existed. And at that point, I just sort of dove right into it. And at the time, I used to drive to Toledo a lot because the closest large synagogue was in Toledo, and I would go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was about 60 miles from Bowling Green, and I used to talk to the rabbi at the Hillel Foundation up there. And then in 1987, I moved back to Champaign, which for what I thought would be just a few months and turned out to be a few years. But I started to participate in events at the Hillel Foundation. I became a board member of Hillel. And at that point, there were two Orthodox rabbis that were driving down from Chicago every other week. And I started to attend the classes that they were teaching. And these were the traditional guys you see on TV with the black coats and the black hats. And one of them had the peos, the earlocks, the long hair on the side of the head. And in 1988, I went to Israel for the first time, and I went to a school in Jerusalem called Ur Sameach, which was a ultra-Orthodox school basically dedicated to people like me, people who had grown up in Jewish cultural traditions but didn't really know very much about religion. Now, I was 34 years old at this time, and I had a master's degree in counseling, and I was fairly well versed in the writings of humanistic psychology and personal growth and self-understanding and self-awareness and self-actualization and all of that. So most of the people that were attending this program were 22-year-old college students who clearly this program was after. Mm-hmm. I understand pretty well the politics of this kind of program.
So there are Jewish evangelicals, too.
Absolutely. Okay. This was a Jewish evangelical group. And when I returned from there a few weeks later, the local rabbi at Hillel here, he expected me to come back sort of, as he said, with my colors flying, with my tzitzits flying. And tzitzits are the traditional ritual sort of strings that are on a garment that you wear. But I went there, and I felt at the time like I was an anthropologist. I was genuinely trying to understand what the Jewish tradition was about that I just didn't understand before then. And so I came back, and I started reading the history of the Reform movement and the history of the Conservative movement and the history of the Orthodox movement and tried to put the Jewish story together in a historical sense. One of the things that I remember at the time that really struck me was I started to read the newspaper. And paying attention to kind of Middle Eastern history. Mm-hmm. And one day there had been this terrible bombing in India where 45 people had been killed in a bombing of a train. It was on page 7 of the New York Times. And on page 1 was some small event that had occurred in Jerusalem where 2 people had died. And I started to ask, well, what's going on? Why is it that 45 people die and they're buried on page 7 and 2 people die in Israel and it's on the first page? And I started to read about Israeli and Middle Eastern history and sort of the modern world of religious history started to appear to me that I did not pay attention to before then.
Rob Silverman is our guest today on Keeping the Faith. This is a live call-in program on WILL every Sunday afternoon from 5 to 6 Central Time. Listeners are encouraged to give us a call and ask a question or make a comment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program. I'm the director of the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. If you'd like to call in, the number anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, 1-800-222-9455 is a free call. That's 1-800-222-WILL. in Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455, and that will get you to several local lines. This program can be accessed for, accessed by people who are farther away by going to WILL.UIUC.edu and then going to AM 580. Rob Silverman has been the executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation. He lived in Israel for about a year and a half, but he grew up in the Midwest, and we're talking today about what it's like to grow up as a Jew in a predominantly Protestant Christian set of communities. And we'll be letting other people ask questions. And I see we have a call on line four. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hello. One subject that you've kind of touched on but haven't really addressed directly, I wanted to know the Rob's opinion. Rob, what do you feel about it when evangelical Protestants approach Jewish people and give them the message of Christianity? What are your thoughts when that does happen?
Well, I have two answers, basically. One is that the deeper one is that I understand it. I mean, as I started to put together the history of the Jewish story, I understand how it developed, the changes that it went through over time, the major changes that it went through in the late 1800s in Germany mostly with the philosophical enlightenment, and how the different groups evolved, if you want to use that word, from the traditional perspectives to the perspectives that we have today, where there's basically a competition of the different kinds of Jewish traditions. I think that's true in the Christian world, too, as well as in other religious communities. So I do not get upset when somebody does that, because I understand that my understanding of Christianity is that that's part of the deal. Where I get less understanding of is when Jewish groups who do not know the history very well get preyed upon. And I think that that happens. And that's more troubling to me, because I think that there is a targeting of people specifically because they don't have a very good understanding of Jewish history. There was an event that occurred here in Champaign-Urbana when I was the director of the Jewish Federation, where the InterVarsity group that comes?
InterVarsity Christian Fellowship brings a group of about 20,000, mainly evangelical Christians, to Champaign-Urbana every third year around just after Christmas time.
Okay.
Called Urbana, then whatever the year is. Urbana 2003 was the last one.
Well, when I was the director of the Jewish Federation, I did that job for 3 years, and in one of those years this group came, and there were 20,000 or so Christian students who were brought here. And they stayed at the dormitories of the University of Illinois campus. Well, following their stay here, the way it works at the university is that students do not have the use of their dormitory room during break, and they're told to put everything away. Well, some of the Jewish students, when they returned, they started getting letters and phone calls and mailings, basically in a conversion attempt. And so somehow they had been identified as Jewish students, and they were targeted because of that. So we met with the university and expressed our discomfort with that, and as far as I know, it was taken care of. Mm. So that's the other side of this, is that from the Jewish perspective, we're just fine. There's not, in the religious story, I guess we are who we are, and that's where we want to be. And there's no need to convert to anything else.
We have another caller waiting on line one. You're on the air. Yes, line one, go ahead.
Rob, from your perspective as someone who's grown up in this community, what kinds of programs are needed for young Jewish boys and girls through junior high school and high school that may not be present at the moment? And that, given your experiences personally and now professionally, what would you recommend in the best of all possible circumstances? I'll hang up and listen.
Well, because I work with teenagers, in settings where we talk about the real world and we talk about the seriousness of things that are going on and the dangers of what's going on. It's not a very safe place to be as a teenager these days. I think it was 1988, 1989, I taught Sunday school for 1 year at Sinai Temple. And the class I taught was called Social Action. And I put together a project that I was very proud of. I set up interviews with various African-American professionals in town, and I divided the class in groups of two. And so two students were to go interview one professional African-American in town, men and women, professional people, service people, business people, academic people, just around the community. And I had spoken to everybody in advance. They were thrilled to participate in this. And I think out of six or seven groups of students, not one of them did it. And none of them told me they weren't going to do it. They all acted as if they were going to do this. And I was extremely disappointed. And it seemed to me that that kind of hands-on program would be very good for the Jewish students. When I was in Sunday school, the classes divided into two groups, the people that hated being there and the people that wanted to be there. I was one of the kids who hated being there. My one Jewish friend, who I said was less Jewish than I was, we used to walk in the front door and walk out the back door and go downtown to Kresge's. This was when Sinai Temple used to be downtown Champaign. So we would go have Cokes on Sunday mornings. Mm-hmm. But in terms of trying to help teenagers understand the reality of today, I believe, and this is a lot of the counseling work I do, is experiential programs are better than just talking about things. It seems to me that a lot of education, Jewish education, and other education is just about talking about stuff, and I don't think that really gets to the heart of where kids are at.
But how to get the students to take part in the experiences you set up, that's not one of the stumbling blocks. We'll get back to that in a minute. We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Robert Silverman, who is a professional counselor who specializes in working with teenagers and families and building communication skills. He's also the current director of Operation Snowball. We'll talk about that. That's a peer counseling program for local high school kids. We're talking about what it's like to grow up Jewish in the Midwest, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Let me give the phone numbers one more time. 333-9455 is a local Champaign-Urbana number where this program originates on WILL AM 580. If you're listening farther away, you may call us free, 1-800-222-9455. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be students who are involved in a program that's trying to improve the lives of animals at the University of Illinois. Kathleen King and some of her friends from SILA will be on the air. And Becca Nieto will be the guest host because I'll be away visiting my grandchildren in Philadelphia. Coming up the following week, Rabbi Dovid Teichtel. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
I've heard it different ways. I've heard it Teichtel.
Okay. We'll be talking about Jewish meditation. This is part of the Whirlwind Project. Robert and I are both involved in the Whirlwind, which is an interfaith program that brings together people who are from Jewish backgrounds, Christian, Muslim backgrounds, other Buddhist and other religions, to try to explore different themes that we share in common. Having the rabbi on the 25th, we'll be talking about meditation, which is the whole theme for the Whirlwind Project for these 2 or 3 months. Also coming up is the Boneyard Arts Festival, and part of that will be some art installations that can be seen Friday and Saturday, next April 16 and 17, all day as part of the Boneyard Arts Festival in Champaign-Urbana. On the Sunday the 18th, the Verde Gallery and Cafe will be featuring a poetry and prose reading, and Robert, you helped organize that. Thank you for doing it. Can you tell us who some of the folks are who will be reading poetry that day from memory? Or that may be hard because I know you've set up 2 or 3 different events like this.
Well, let me see if I can list them. The readers on Sunday the 18th will be a woman, Karen Kowalski Singer, Zerniel Bogan, who's an associate minister at the Salem Baptist Church.
And this will be Sunday, April 18 at 1 in the afternoon at Verde Gallery. The concert for the Songs of Meditation at Salem Baptist Church will be Monday, April 26 at 7 p.m. Folks might want to put that on your calendar. That's been a marvelous event the last 2 years with a wonderful assortment of music from many different faith traditions. That's Monday, April 26, 7 p.m. at Salem Baptist Church in Champaign, 500 East Park. And the Whirlwind Series this year ends with a May 1st foods celebration at an interfaith meditation service at Wesley. That's a Saturday afternoon, May 1st, 4 p.m. And it's a potluck, so people are encouraged to bring a dish to share. Drinks will be provided and things to eat off of and drink from. So that's May 1st. That'll be the big final event of Whirlwind for this year.
Now, there's four other readers who I didn't mention.
I remember their
names. So it's Cynthia Randolph, Wendy Heller, Brian Russo, and Robert Manister. And they're excellent writers, and I would encourage everybody to attend. We had a reading on March 28th where there were probably 50 people in the audience, and this will be the end of the Boneyard Arts Festival, and the place should be packed.
It's been a nice series. Coming up on Keeping the Faith later this month, in May, will be Walter Matherly talking, reading some of his poetry. Clayton Doffenbaugh, May 9th, about creating local democracy. And Barbara Jones will be speaking from the perspective of a professional in the field of library science on censorship on May 16th. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois. It was started by students in 1873. Since that time, it has been helping to develop student leaders by providing opportunities for just what Rob was talking about earlier, social action and community service, and developing values by being exposed to people very different from themselves. One of the Y programs coming up this week is one of our programs we're very proud of. Amnesty International is the local group, is out of the University YMCA. And there's going to be a documentary film shown Tuesday night. It's free at 7 o'clock, April 13. It's called Dangerous Living, Coming Out in the Developing World. And it's a documentary that's narrated by Janine Garofalo, about an hour long, and it talks about what it's like to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered in places like Honduras, Uganda, Malaysia, the Philippines, India, Thailand, and Egypt. And in fact, one of the young men who will be accompanying the film and answering questions about it was one of the 52 Egyptian youth in Cairo, Egypt, that were persecuted for being gay. So that's Tuesday night at the Y, 7 o'clock, sponsored by Amnesty International, one of the Y programs. This Friday, April 16, will be the last Friday forum at the Y. Associate Provost Earl Kellogg will be talking about internationalizing higher education. Earl is the Associate Provost for International Affairs at the university, and that's a free lecture this Friday, April 16, at noon at the University Y. That's at 1001 South Wright in Champaign. If you have questions about these Y programs or any others, please call me, Steve Shoemaker, during the week, 337-1500. The Y's big fundraiser is coming up April 23rd. It's our annual auction. If you've never been to a charity auction, you're going to go out and eat that week anyway. Why not come to the Hawthorne Suites, eat with people who are going to be gathering together to have this fun auction? A lot of people in the community have donated interesting things to be auctioned off. Some will be a silent auction where you just write a number on a card and see if you're the highest one at the end of the evening. You're going to get some bargains. You get a lot of free things. A lot of businesses have donated gift certificates, so you may well get that free for a dinner out or a videotape or all sorts of things. And there's some really nice bargains. So that's April 23rd, Friday night, 6:30 at the Hawthorne Suites Hotel. to make a reservation, please call the University Y this week. I guarantee you'll have a good time and meet some interesting people and have a chance for some bargains. Well, we have another caller for our guest, Rob Silverman. Let's go to line 4. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that as my children were growing up, we did not live in this area, and we felt really pleased that our children happened to have a number of strong Jewish families that we were friends with. And my children, kind of as they were young, they grew up with the impression that half the world was Jewish, and had a very kind of skewed view of the size of the Jewish population of the town they actually lived in. How big is the actual Jewish population in Champaign-Urbana? I find so few signs of the local Jewish population. I know when I go out to try to even find cards for Hanukkah or Passover, sometimes I find it very difficult to even find those things. Also, I wonder, the family traditions and things that we experienced with our Jewish friends were really enriching to me and to my family. And I would like to find out more, not from a standpoint of converting or anything, but just to find out more about the history of those traditions and the background in some of those traditions. They seemed very rich to me as I was experiencing them with my friends, and I certainly miss having those experiences now.
As of the last census count, I think that was in 1990. I don't know if the recent one has been out yet, but the official population, Jewish population in Champaign-Urbana was 1,350. Now, we know that that's not an accurate count. There are a lot of people who are Jewish who do not identify and probably don't put that down on their census data. It also doesn't count the University of Illinois students, of which there are approximately 3,000 Jewish students. In terms of where somebody could go to learn information, Sinai Temple used to offer a course that was sort of a basic Judaism 101 kind of a course that was very pleasant. I remember taking it once because I was referring people to it, so I wanted to know what they were doing there. And it's mostly people who are not Jewish, some people who are married to somebody who's Jewish, some people who are friends with somebody who's Jewish, but it was a basic information class for people to find out what the story is all about. My experience there was that it was very good. And I want to be really clear here that when I was growing up in this community, it was most of the time the Sinai Temple was in downtown Champaign. It was significantly smaller than it is now. There were many fewer teachers, many fewer professionals, and the quality of religious education that's occurring now, I think, is significantly higher than it was when I was growing up here.
But there still may be young people growing up in Jewish families who are as resistant as young people growing up in Christian families are to paying attention to their religious faith of their parents. And that may happen, as in your case, when they're 20s or 30s or perhaps never. But
that is very true. And it happens in all the different communities. In the counseling world, in this community especially, it's not uncommon to have parents who come from East Asia or South America or any country around the world who have American teenagers. And the clash of values that exist in families like that can be tremendous. It can be very, very difficult.
Now, Rob, I always try to ask at least one mean question during this hour. Now, you don't have any kids of your own. How can you work with teenagers? How can you work with families when they have problems with teenagers?
It's one of the ironies of my life. It's a question I struggled with. I struggled with it a lot when I was first starting off in the counseling field, and I left the field a couple of times. I think one of the reasons I went to Israel is because I was trying to place myself within the Jewish community. I just never quite was sure where I fit. And as I, you know, as it goes, I can explain it all. I just can't really explain why I never got married and why I don't have kids. One of the things that I tell parents when I meet with them, and I usually say it in the first 30 minutes, is that when it comes to talking about kids and raising kids, I don't have a clue. And I understand that I don't have a clue. And then I go on to explain that that's not what counseling's about. It's not having some, you know, person who knows it all tell you what to do or to give advice. It's about learning communication skills, learning how the system of communication works so that various emotions can be allowed to exist and talked about with openness and not shut down.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're director of Operation Snowball. Tell us what that is.
Operation Snowball is now entering into its 25th year in this community. It's a peer counseling program for high school-aged teens. We have participants across the high schools in Champaign County, and mostly it's experiential education, emotional education. We have a weekly meeting on Tuesday nights at the McKinley Foundation on campus. We rent an office from them. We're not affiliated with them. And twice a year, we have weekend retreats at the Allerton Park 4-H camp. Most of the activities there have to deal with communication, skill building, self-awareness, education in substance abuse, and various emotional territory that adolescents need to navigate if they're going to become successful adults.
We're talking with Rob Silverman, who's a professional counselor, about what it's like to grow up in Jewish in a town in the Midwest as a religious minority. We're in our last quarter of this hour. If you have a call, a question, please give us a call. 1-800-222-9455 is a free call. From anywhere the program's heard in Champaign-Urbana, please use a local line, 333-9455. So, Rob, what are the religious questions that teenagers have who are asking them? You kind of avoided that when you were growing up, but there are kids who just really want to know. What are some of the questions they're asking these days?
It's interesting. When that topic does come up in, say, an Operation Snowball meeting, it's one of those topics that get people on the edge of their chairs. Mm-hmm. We have teens that come from a variety of different religious groups. Sometimes kids talk about it openly, sometimes not. The theological discussions tend to be on the fairly simple side, if I can say that, because they have to be at that age, I think. I think it's, if I were to sort of categorize this, I think that the discussion is more about identity than it really is about religion. I think kids are struggling with their identity and who they are and what they believe in, and religion is one of those topics. I guess I espouse the opinion that it's better to talk about it openly and to explore the things that people disagree with, as opposed to having places where they are told what they have to think. Because in my experience, when you tell teenagers what to think, they're going to go in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do some direct teaching as well as counseling. You're active at Sinai Temple. You've been director of the Jewish Federation for 3 years. I know you're doing a class in therapeutic writing coming up soon. But when you, as a self-conscious, religious, practicing Jew, talk about, say, the Torah, how do you teach other people, young people, about that when there's so many questions about the Torah and who wrote it and all those things?
I don't think that I teach that. I participate in a group at Sinai. It's a Torah study class every Saturday morning, and this group's been meeting for the last 7 years. And in my opinion, one of the critical questions that I rarely hear about, and I don't really understand it, I think the reason it's not talked about is because it's too hot. It's too important of a question, and it comes down to who wrote the books. Mm-hmm. As I understand, at least the Jewish story and my basic understanding of Christianity and Islam, of using those two other groups, the big question between the different denominations is who wrote the books. With And I'm going to use the term fundamentalist loosely. I do not mean it in a derogatory sense. I know it sometimes gets used like that, but I use it because it defines groups in an easy way. So on one side, you have fundamentalist groups or evangelical groups, whether they're Jewish, Christian, or Islamic, who believe that God wrote the book and that cannot be changed and you can't mess with it. And they're fighting words, basically. And then the other side is the group that believes that these texts and books were written by human beings, usually men, because at that point men were writing these books, and that because they were written by human beings, they can be understood differently than they were written by God. And that is such a difficult question to deal with, that it's difficult to talk about. It doesn't fit into a soundbite very well.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's the question that causes people to lose their minds sometimes. And I say that, when I lived in Israel for about a year and a half, and I had a friend who was a psychiatric social worker, and she worked in one of the local hospitals, and she told me once that in Jerusalem there's a psychiatric hospital that has entire wings of, you know, whole floors of people who think they're Jesus, or whole floors of people who think they're Muhammad or Moses. And that it's not an uncommon phenomenon for somebody to go to Israel who's not particularly stable, and they begin to have these delusions that they are these people.
And so you have some scholars in this group who make a study of the Torah, of the first five books of the Jewish Tanakh, or Jewish Bible, for which Christians sometimes refer to as the Prime Testament or the First Testament or the Old Testament. What are those discussions like?
Well, it's interesting. We have people within that group who focus on different areas. We have a number of there's a couple of Israelis who attend, and it's very useful because they can read it in the original language. And we've all learned that when these books are into English, it's not exactly what it says.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to have people who understand the original language. One of the things that we try to do on a fairly regular basis is try to place the text into a historical context to understand what the politics were at the time that the books were being written, so that we can understand that these have a relationship to that time, not necessarily to this time. Now, that's a difficult thing for some people to do because they want to take this text and run ahead a few thousand years and say that it had to do with our time. But that's a leap that we try to stay away from because it takes us out of the historical context.
So you at least begin by saying, what did it mean then?
What did it mean then?
Mm-hmm. For people who are part of that group who say, well, God was at least in some way involved in this process, even if human beings, you know, wrote these books, God inspired them or led them or directed them, or who knows, there are a lot of ways you can say that. Are there people there who say that, who say that there was some divinity involved in this?
Sometimes.
Okay. Does that make a difference?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think it convinces anybody. Nobody's going to change
How could you prove it?
Yeah, how could you prove it? I think the one thing that does come across repeatedly, and that's that the level of depth that these stories have and the complexity and the interwovenness, where one story is intimately involved in a different story that could be literally hundreds of pages away in the text, to build in that kind of complexity took an intellect and an understanding and a compassion and such a connection to the human condition that it's certainly understandable that people will say this was written by God. I mean, I understand that just because it's such a rich and complex series of books.
So they're inspiring, even if you can't say for certain they were inspired.
Yes. Okay. And we struggle with the notion of supernaturalism sometimes.
Sure.
The supernatural events and stories that take place.
Miracles.
Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things.
How can a modern scientific person understand that?
Well, not only that, but it's hard, and I've said this a few times in the group, it's hard to justify our own supernatural events if we want to tell other groups that they shouldn't have a right to their supernatural events. So That creates a problem.
Tell us about the writing class you're going to be teaching soon.
At Verde Cafe, starting on May the 3rd, I worked it out with Kurt, the owner of the Verde Gallery. I'm going to be doing a therapeutic writing class where we talk about basically how to take emotions and write about them, how to understand our own personal histories in a therapeutic way so that we can write about it on paper. Now, I need to stress that even though I'm a counselor, this is not a therapy group. And it says so on the brochure. If anybody's interested, they could call me. Do I give a phone number here? Call me at 766-4327 or to contact Kurt at the Verde Gallery, and he can explain the details.
And there is a cost for that class.
There is a cost. It'll be $125. It's six classes of 2 hours each plus a 30-minute individual session to talk about writing. And I think that there's going to be some kind of a journal book that's given out as part of a class membership.
And if listeners who are parents of teenagers think that Operation Snowball might be of help to their teenagers, how can they get more information about that?
The phone number of Operation Snowball is 337-5809, and we are listed in the telephone book and on the United Way website.
And you meet how often?
We meet on Tuesdays from 7 till 9 p.m. at the McKinley Foundation, which is the corner of 5th and Daniel, 809 South 5th in Champaign.
I want to thank Robert Silverman for being our guest today on Keeping the Faith, talking about growing up Jewish in Champaign-Urbana. And thank also to our callers who called with comments or questions. Coming up at the University Y this week, again, is a documentary film, free showing on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, of Dangerous Living, Coming Out in the Developing World, What It's Like to Be Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, or Transgendered in the Developing World. That's Tuesday night at the University of Y, 10-01 South Wright in Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the director of the Y, and this program the documentary film is sponsored by Amnesty International, one of the Y programs. Also, this month at the Y is our big auction, April 23rd, Friday night at 6:30. I encourage people to call the Y and make reservations for that auction. The number of the Y is 337-1500. Call during the week, please. Coming up on Keeping the Faith, next week we'll be talking with Kathleen King and other students from Students Improving the Lives of Animals. Becca Nieto will be the guest host for that program because I'll be out of state traveling. And then the following week, Rabbi Dovid Teichtel. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Kate Davis loves horse races. Mark Moskowitz loves political races. They joined us on stage to talk about her documentary, Jockey, and his life producing political ads as we faced a live audience at the Wisconsin Film Festival. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, Film on Radio, where the images are always crystal clear. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriFab Incorporated, Sullivan, Anderson Foundation, Body Works Associates, Champaign, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
There's no better time than now to plan for tornado season. Join WILL Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser for a free interactive talk on tornado safety. Ed separates the facts from the myths using real tornado video and colorful graphics as his guide, and your questions are invited. Join Ed Tuesday at 7 p.m. in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute, located on the U of I campus on the southeast corner of Wright Street and University Avenue in Urbana. For more information, call 244-5072.